The dickheads are presented in color.
Oh, wait a second. Like a pink laser beam of truth beaming straight from Ohio, Colorado to your ear holes. This is the Dickheads Podcast. We have a very special episode. One we have been gearing up to do since we pushed record on the first episode, because one of the most valuable sources of information that I have is the Pink Beam Companion, written by our guest today, Lord Running Clam. Yes, you might remember that name. You might recognize it, and we'll talk about that later. But every time I give a chronology or what was written here and when did he write this and what did PKD say about this book, 9 times out of 10, I got it from the Pink Beam Companion or the corresponding website, the Phil Dickian Encyclopedia of Dick that's online. So that's where you get the information. And the person who compiled all that is our guest today. And that's extremely exciting for myself and my co-host here, David Wilson. Welcome, David, again to the show.
Thank you,
so Lord Running Clam, how did you get into Philip K. Dick? Where did this journey start for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I understand you lived in Indiana, right, David?
I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, yes.
Oh, right. Well, for many years, I lived in Indiana. I had two wives there, and I was working at Delco Electronics in Kokomo. You know Kokomo?
Yeah, it's a little further north than me, but yes, I'm very aware of Kokomo. I'm excited to hear you have an Indiana connection.
Here in
Judging from your voice, you didn't grow up in Indiana, but...
No, I didn't. No. That's my Ganymedian accent, man. So I'll get started on this because you, David, want to hear this story. I worked at Delco Electronics for 10 years from 78 to 88. As an industrial electrician, I maintained, you know, I'd go around and fix all the machines when they broke down. It was my job to fix them, anything from light bulbs to computers. You know, that was what I did. Union job, United Auto Workers. I'm real proud to be a union worker. So a union factory worker for General Motors at Delco Electronics in Kokomo. And about 1980, in fact, it was 1984, being on second shift, you know, evening shift, you get your machines fixed, you go sit on your ass somewhere, read a book. Okay, I was wandering around and I walked into the tool and die department. There laying on one of the CNC machines was Eye in the Sky. I actually have I still have the edition from 40 years ago. From it was 1984, and I'll show it to you.
Right here.
This is the edition I had. And that's that's the actual book I read. I hate to take it out of the bag because it's falling apart. So this was laying on a machine. I picked it up. It's about 10 o'clock at night. And I sat down somewhere in a corner somewhere and started reading it. And I started reading it. And I read it till midnight when I got off. I went home and I sat down, smoked a joint in my little study, like similar to what I have here. And I read and read and I finished it all off. And it's about 4 in the morning or something. I finished it off. And I just looked up and it's like my room, it just sort of like disappeared. It's like I couldn't tell what was real and what was not. It just vanished. And I sort of, so of course I did what all the dickheads do. The next day I went out to the bookstores in Kokomo and I looked for what I could find. And the first Philip K. Dick, this was 84, was Scanner Darkly and Valis. So I read Eye in the Sky, blew my mind. And I read A Scanner Darkly. And what that did for me after in conjunction with Valis was, you know, I'm wanting to be a writer, okay? I am scribbling away in this factory in these secret corners, you know, trying to write some fiction. And I realized, wow, man, Philip K. Dick's written everything I would possibly ever want to write. He's done my job for me, which means I don't have to. I just become a fan of Philip K. Dick. As far as I'm concerned, he whatever he writes is what I would have written if I was would have been a writer. So I read A Scanner Darkly, and this is, of course, you know, and this is 84, and Scanner Darkly really is about drug, not so much about drug abuse, but about drugs in a society. And it was written in, I believe, 70, 72, which is when I first come to America and, first started smoking pot, okay? So I always assumed that substance D was an analog for marijuana, because the repression, being in the military at the time, 72, 76, I was in the U.S. Air Force. I joined the Air Force right after I came here, okay? So living on the barracks, we had, of course, you don't want to be caught smoking pot in the barracks. It'd be like falling down before you're in a brick somewhere, you know? So I always thought of Scanner Darkly was about, the sort of repression and the life people have to live if they're smoking marijuana in the 70s, okay, or even on into the 80s, because it was the same situation in Indiana, of course, David, as you well know. You smoke a joint in Indiana, they'll have to lock you up for life, you know. So I thought Scanner was about then. I read Valis, and then, I just picked him up at random. It was a lot of fun. It'd be late 80s and on into the 90s. It was always fun to go to the bookstores, and wherever you went, I'd always look for Philip K. Dick, and there was quite a few in the bookstores back then. Nowadays, there's hardly anything. You can't find a used Philip K. Dick book anywhere. Yeah, and so that's how I became a fan of Philip Dick. I thought that he was the greatest writer, and if I wanted to be a writer, I would write. I wouldn't write like Philip K. Dick. I would write what Philip K. Dick wrote. You understand the difference? Now let's talk about, we got some great writers who followed. Like, I think of Jonathan Lethem. I'm reading his novels now. I'm reading The Arrest, fantastic book. He's got some fantastic novels out there, and he did what I did. He went out there to California and became a writer and made it famous. I always thought Jonathan was brilliant that he could do that. Here I am in Indiana. I got four kids to feed. You know what I mean?
And so, where were you born, and where did you grow up originally? Because that accent is not Indiana. I can tell that.
Well, I've been asked this question so many times. Sometimes I say Mars, sometimes I say Ganymede, but I was actually born in England, in a little shithole town in England called Luton. I don't know if you ever heard of Luton. It's just a little north of London. It's a dump, okay. Well, it was back then. They spruced it up now, but back in the 50s, 60s, when I grew up, it was a dump. And so I'm from England originally.
Okay. When those first couple of years of just finding the books, when did you start to really take seriously studying this? Because it's one thing to read Philip K. Dick, which we all had that period. And then there's another period where those of us who take this on as a scholarly endeavor, jump to the next level. How did that step come about?
Well, that came about probably right after I started reading Philip Dick, because in the edition of Scanner Darkly I had, it was a paperback. There was right on the front page was Philip K. Dick Society, P.O. Box 6011, Glen Allen, California. Wow, of course, I wrote those guys, and I got a nice letter back from Paul Williams, and I subscribed to the Philip K. Dick newsletter. Of course, it went from 82 to 92. So I subscribed probably about late 84, maybe early 85, I don't know. And I got all the newsletters, and I'm trying, because there was no bibliographers back then. There was no really list of what Philip K. Dick had written. There was no internet. You know, where did you go to find this stuff? You read about it in the PKDS newsletter. So I started keeping notes. But what really kicked me off was in 1988, I bought a Commodore Amiga 500 computer. Beautiful computer, best computer ever built. I loved it. So I started taking notes from the newsletter, any source I could find, and logged them into not really a database. I just kept notes, okay. And that all went on for several years. Then in 1995, I bought a Windows 95 computer. I ordered a special fancy Windows 95 computer, and I transferred all my Amiga stuff to the Windows 95 floppy disk. You know, those little square disks that they used to have, and I just went from there. I just started compiling stuff, man. I just grabbed it from everywhere and logged it where I could. And it took to write Pink Beam, from 95 to say about 99, I was compiling stuff, saving notes and putting it all together and starting on different cover pictures, which was a basis for bibliographies. You know, I had all these strange Italian editions or Spanish editions or what have you, and I'm trying to sort it all out. So after I got that, then I started writing Pink Beam probably in about 98, 99. And in 99, it was a case of, Indiana doesn't want me anymore, so I had to leave. I won't go in all that. But anyway, I moved to Colorado to Ward, Colorado, which is 9,300 feet up in the mountains west of Boulder. And I found a home there. My brother was there, and I moved in with my brother into a little log cabin about the size of this room. It was cold. It was, you can imagine what it's like 9,300 feet in the winters in Colorado. It's a cold son of a bitch. So I'm up there in this little cabin with an old computer, and I've got little gloves on my hand with my fingertips sticking out because it was so freaking cold, and I'm banging this thing out. So I banged it out between, basically 2001 to 2004. I probably got it finished in 2004. Then I looked for a publisher, and I was working at the Ward Post Office as a substitute postmaster, and the guy who was delivering the mail around the mountain communities, he was an artist and a musician. He was an old punk musician who hung out with these guys at Studio 54 and all that, Blondie and all these bands. He knew all these people and all these old punks, okay? Well, he said, well, why don't you go to Lulu.com? They'll help you publish it. So I went to Lulu.com, and as you can see, that I just took my Word document and that was it, shoved it all in there, and they published it. And Mark, my buddy at the post office, he did the brilliant cover with the pink beam on it. He's I've lost touch with him lately, but a guy named Mark Ivins, he did the cover, and then I published it out on Lulu in 2007, I believe. And here we are. I wanted to do a second edition.
Now we got to go back a little bit and talk about some of this process where you're up there in the mountains putting this all together. But in these early days when the PKD Society newsletter was going out, look, we have a really active and vibrant PKD community online. Now we've got Facebook groups. We have all this stuff. Mm-hmm. You guys were doing this before the internet. So you guys were probably trading letters and information in those days. So can you tell us a little bit about the pioneer days of doing this?
Okay, we'll go back to working at Delco Electronics I quit in 88, okay? I had 10 years and they paid me to quit my job. I was so fucking happy to get out of there. It was insane. That place was, I should write a book about Delco Electronics, man. It was fucking insane. And anyway, what was the question again? I spaced out.
The early days of communicating.
All right, yeah, I got you. Okay, so about 1987, I've been reading Hunter Thompson. I read his Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72, and that inspired me. And then, of course, I read Your Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and anything else I could find by him, too. And it inspired me to do a political newsletter, a zine, while I was working in fact. So in about 1980, I thought, well, I'll cover the 1980 election like Hunter Thompson did the 72 election. So I started writing articles and again, different shit. And I published a zine. And what was so cool about that was I had, working on second shift, I had free run of all the copying machines at Delco Electronics. I go up to the admin building, and I this was called No Bullshit, either one was the name of this scene, this political scene. Oh, it's my breakthrough. And I copy it off, and I go up to sneak up into the admin offices in the middle of the night, 10 o'clock at night, there's nobody around. They had this great big long IBM printer that you stick your copy in one end, and about 20 feet later, chunks out, collated, stapled, and the whole bit the other end. It's going ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. I just cranked a whole bunch of these out. And I got a hold of Fact Sheet 5, which was run by a man named Mike Gundeloy. Basically, what that was a review of all the zines coming out in that period. And I sent copies of this politics newsletter, No Bullshit, out to random people. And I met people like Kerry Formley. There's all kinds of people. I didn't know who the hell they were. Realized later on they're all semi-famous. But I was a correspondent, so I'd send out my zine, and I'd write letters. I must have wrote, 50 letters a week or something. I was writing letters. Everybody sent it out my zine. And then Paul Williams in 1991, he announced that he was going to retire the Philip Dick PKDS newsletter. And well, that shook me up, man. Oh, God, what am I going to do now? Oh, my God. So I said, well, and Paul said, well, we're going to hope some other people step in and do a Philip Dick newsletter. And I said, I talked to my wife, Barbara, at the time. who was part of, we'd already been doing our Ganymede and Slime Mold on tour sort of thing. You know, we had this little unit, me, my wife and her brother. We called ourselves a Ganymede and Slime Mold. So anyway, that's where I got my name, Lord Running Clan. My then wife gave it to me. And I said, well, we'd do it. And I cranked out the first edition of FDO on my old Amiga. And I sent it out, and I sent to Paul Williams and Andy Watson there in California with the Glenn Eller. Andy, I mostly worked with Andy. I had a lot of a really long correspondence with Andy Watson, and that faded out maybe towards the end of the 90s. And that was it. That's for decades only. I mean, we managed to do, let me think, 6 or 7 issues, I forget. You know, it was my introduction to the world of Philip K. Dick. I can now write about it, you know. So I did. I'm not saying any of that stuff I wrote about that then was very good, but I did.
Was it an annual publication? Like when you ran
no.
with? Oh, okay.
Whenever I could get it done, yeah. And I had a lot of help. You know, the first one was just a printer copied and stapled on the corner and half 8, 6, 8, 10 sheets, whatever. Sure. And then after a while, I had help from people like Scott Polenz and, gosh darn it, the guy who was behind in the next, I can't remember his name. Anyway, I had help from these people who instead of having it just a corner staple, we folded it in half, stapled it down the middle, made it a wraparound cover, made it into a nice looking edition. So by time number 4 came out, which is a Solar Lottery edition, it looked really great. You know, Perry Kingman helped me. Perry, he passed away sadly, a big dickhead from Japan. And it got better and better and better. And then the internet came along, and you know, I did one edition for, I believe it was in 97. And I called it Edika, like a Russian edition of the Edika. I had no fucking idea, you know. That's what I called it. And I put that online. And then after that, of course, you know, 97, 98, things are falling apart in Indiana. And, you know, there's a hiatus between then and moving to Colorado.
Well, I know our listeners are probably screaming like, hey, go back and talk about this Slime Mold tour thing. Because... It sounds like the PKD love was a family affair if your wife is knowledgeable enough about Clans of the Alphane Moon to name you Lord Running Clan. So go back. What were you guys doing? How did you get her into it? What was the deal on that?
Well, okay, I'll get it. Just let me show you a copy of it.
And the other thing is, Lord Running Clan, is that from... I should know this if, in fact, this is the case. Is that from a Philip K. Dick term, Lord Running Clan?
Yeah, this is a character in Clans of the Alphane Moon.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah,
he's a Ganymedian. I read that one.
He's a Ganymedian slime mold in Clans of the Alphane Moon. So anyway, this book tells all about that stuff in there. Okay, there's a whole bunch of shit in there. And we published this through Wide Books a number of years ago.
So what's the title again? Because for the people who are not watching, the people who are listening at home, Slime Mold on the Move.
No, Ganymede and Slime Mold on Tour.
On Tour. Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. And it's published by Henri Wintz and I in through Wide Books, our Philip K. Dick publishing company. So, okay, you want to know about us on tour. So, yeah, we're in Kokomo. We're very political, you know, very political, okay? But we're also a bunch of later-day hippies sort of thing, you know? My wife and her brother he looked like a young Carlos Santana. This is in the 80s, okay? He always had bell-bottoms with the fringes and the jingles and the jangles and the hippie gear on. He looked like a hippie straight out of 1967. He's trying to resurrect in 1987, he's trying to resurrect 1967, the Summer of Love. Okay, so hell yeah, we'll go on tour. We'll go resurrect the Summer of Love. So we went to Rainbow Gatherings, Grateful Dead concerts, all over the place. We went to New York City, North Carolina, Wisconsin. God, we drove all over the place on tour, and everywhere we went, we had a a Ubik flag, which was basically just a pole with a half a bed sheet with pink Ubiks written on it in big letters, you know, the old Ubik flag. We'd float out where we went, and people would stop and talk to us about Philip Dick. Who's that? You know, what's this? And we also, of course, being zinesters, we always had a whole bunch of zines to hand out. Some of my no bullshit zines in the 80s, and a few of the early FBOs and whatever we have. We make special things up, and we just, you know, having the copiers at General Motors there, at Delco, and also later on when I moved to the Uniroyal Goodrich factory in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They were a bunch of assholes up there, but I still got to use their machines, okay, even though they didn't like it.
I lived there for 5 years in Fort Wayne.
You did?
I did, yeah.
Well, you remember that bookshop downstairs, downtown? What was it? Like Dave somebody ran. Another Dave, I think, ran the damn thing. Dave. It's on Washington or Jefferson there in Fort Wayne. Yeah, I love Fort Wayne. I mean, I actually lived in New Haven, which is a little
place. Sure.
Yeah, and the Goodrich factory was even further in Woodburn, almost to the Ohio border.
Okay.
So that's where I lived. But that's where I used all that. That's where I print out a lot of the latter-day stuff we took on tour.
Oh.
And we just had fun.
I think half the zine movement of the 80s and 90s worked at Kinko's overnights and got that job specifically to make their zines. So... You know, that's a part of zine culture, is figuring out how you're going to get your free copies, right?
We had a ball. We really did. It was a blast. We had a few bad moments, of course, like when we got busted at the Canadian border, which was it's in my book, but it was hilarious.
For illegal Ubik spray cans in your...
Yeah, we had illegal Ubik in the trunk, right?
Yeah.
Right. No, man, we had some pot. I mean, we called him Uncle John or Reverend Dr. X. My wife's brother, his name was John, but he took the sobriquet Reverend Dr. X. Okay, so he's Reverend Dr. X, part of the slime mold, you know. And he paid for what he always wanted, to have some pot, and he didn't know about getting it. We were on our way to Toronto for the Anarchist Festival that year. I forget what it was, 88, I think, 88. We got on the Anarchist Festival in Toronto. So we drive up from Indiana to Port Huron, Michigan with the car, the Slimemobile, and on the back of it is a little trailer we could sleep in, you know. And we had the kids with us. So there's me, Barbara, Uncle John, four kids. We're raising four kids. Jammed in this car and this trailer, and we get to the border there in Port Huron, and they asked us, because I didn't even have a passport. All I had was my Indiana driver's license, you know. It's like, well, we are totally clueless. I thought you just drive into Canada, no big deal, you know. What the fuck? No. So they stopped us on the U.S. side, and they asked Rev Dr. X, have you ever been in trouble with the law concerning drugs? He goes, Of course, when they saw that look on his face, man, they tore our car apart. They tore the trailer apart. They strip searched us, searched the kids, and then they found a little baggie of marijuana buried in the trailer somewhere. Since yours, no. Well, what happened was Rev Dr. X, he took the fall. They tossed him in the Port Huron. This was July the 4th in 87, 88, I think. They tossed his ass in a slammer over a weekend. Well, me and Bob and the kids hung out in Port Huron along the lake there, you know, and we sat and watched we could see the fireworks going off all the way around Lake Huron. It was fantastic. So then this is all in my book. I won't go into it, but then we had to go to the arraignment on the Monday morning or whatever it was, after the July the 4th. And there's John, there's the judge, some grumpy looking old fucker, you know, and there's all these people in the court, poor Mexicans and shit, waiting their turn at justice. John gets up on the stand. He's just emanating bad attitude palpably. You know, he's really scowling at the judge, and you can't judge. He's going on like a random raven, and he grabs a hold of me. He's a true freak, hippie freak, a real brother. And he pulls me up there on the stand, so I get up there, and I'm saying, "Your Honor, he's really sick. You gotta be careful with this guy. He's really got problems with his health. You know, I'm trying to excuse his action." And the judge just goes, "I merely interpret the law," and he fined him, I think, $300 or whatever, and let us go, you know. And we took him out, and they decided to take a check. So I wrote him a check for $300 to whatever court it was in Port Huron. I got off back to Indiana. I haven't been back since. And the minute I got back to Indiana, I canceled the check. So fuck them, you know what I'm saying? I haven't been back to Michigan since. So that was our tour. And we moved on down to the Rainbow Gathering in North Carolina, that Asheville. That was a lot of fun. The Grateful Dead concerts. We traveled around a lot. Yeah, we had a ball.
You had the experience of going on all these tours and promote, and you guys were promoting Philip K. Dick. Like, I'm sure in your experience, did you ever have people eventually contact you and say, like, hey, I became a dickhead because you guys,
I can't recall that. I do remember down in Florida, in St. Petersburg, my brother was living there, and he had a couple of young girls. Well, not, you know, there's a couple of young girls in his circle. And I was talking about being on tour for the Grateful Dead, and they liked it so much they themselves joined the Dead tour, so they went and followed the Dead around. So that's really the only influence I had then. Yeah. I don't know if I ever inspired any Philip K. Dick people. I have no idea.
Did you follow the? Did you? Were you a Dead follower?
Only to a small degree. We went to a lot of their concerts, but we don't always go see the shows, you know.
Yeah.
So it's because we're peddling our wares. You know, it was a lot of fun. We went to as part of our tour, we went to New York City. Again, it was '88 for the Madison Square Garden Dead shows in August of '88. Uh-huh. And oh man, we went. It was a fantastic show. And of course, you know, we've been going to like the Wisconsin and these other shows where it's more of an outdoor concert, but in New York City, you've got Madison Square Garden. It's in the middle of the city. There's no parks or nothing around it, so everybody hangs out on the street around the Madison Square Garden.
I mean, I used to go to those in the early '90s, and that's why I asked, because it's more like it's a spectacle, right? It's kind of a circus,
mm-hmm.
like the perfect place to peddle PKD paraphernalia, you know.
Yeah, it was, man. I hooked up with it was like, well, you know, it's hard, you know, when you got a bunch of papers in your hand and there's 1,000 people running all around you gotta get, I gotta get rid of this shit. I can't not do it. You gotta go out there and you gotta go out and talk to these people and say, hey buddy, why don't you read this?
Yeah, yeah.
Give me some spare change, you know. And of course, I ended up with pockets full of money, you know, but my pockets are bulging with quarters and nickels and shit, made enough to cover maybe cigarettes, you know what I mean? Yeah, I was a boy, I'm not dead.
Most of these travels were before you started doing the hardcore research, though, right?
No, they were in the middle of it, really. Philip K. Dick was always a part of what I was doing. I was always reading his books and thinking, and also putting out FDO, you know, for Dickheads Only. I was always publishing that in the 90s, too. So it was all intertwined. It was all mixed in together.
All right, so tell me about the actual research for Pink Beam. Like, did you start it kind of by accident through doing the newsletter or the zine? And then just realize that you had all this stuff, or did you have a plan from the beginning for this timeline? Because that's really what it is.
It is. It's a chronology. I never had any really plans. I just started compiling the stuff, and then finally it just sort of, I had so much, and I started sorting it out, and I knew I had to comment on all the short stories, so I had all 5 volumes of the short stories. So I read all of them, and I wrote what it was, you see in the Pink Beam. I wrote my reviews and my, you know, my ratings and all that. And after that, of course, I had to read the novels again, sort of thing. So it all sort of fell together somehow. I don't know. Maybe I have some sort of minor ability in organizing and stuff like that. I don't know.
Well,
follow-up. Did anything, I'm trying to think of dates here, anything exists before Pink Beam like that sort of timeline? I mean, it's a really engaged and detailed timeline. Is that the first sort of?
Well, there are a couple of zines that dealt with Philip Dick. I remember one called Dixieland. I think it's by Arthur Halaverty out of maybe somewhere down south, maybe New Orleans or somewhere, called Dixieland. I had that, and I, you know, when I'm sending all my zines out to all these people through Factsheet 5, and they're sending all their stuff back to me, because, you know, nobody, I've got a few checks here and there, you know, but mostly you get stuff in kind, you know, so I'm getting all these weird zines, and you know, it just sort of, I don't know, it just sort of went on from there, man.
Yeah. Well, and it's really, I mean, the detail that you get down to about like the date and times, like how when did you know you were gonna like actually do like down to the very dates that he wrote everything?
That was probably in 1999, when I just before I left Indiana in 2000 to come to the mountains. And what happened was, I still had a Windows computer. I don't know if it's my original one. So I started working on it in Indiana. I started putting it together in Indiana, writing the Pink Beam. And what happened was, the year 2000 was coming, you know, the 2000 computer bust. Okay, so I've copied all my photocopied data onto these little square floppies, you know. I had a big stack of them. I still got the damn things, that, you know, 50 different, you know, floppies. And I copied everything onto there, and then just as soon as 2000 hit, my computer crashed, black screen of death. I'm glad I got it off of there in time. And that you mentioned earlier on online, the Encyclopedia Dickiana sort of website I have. I built that before I wrote my book. So working on that website, which is now on PhilipKDickFans.com.
What was like your process of finding those dates? Because one of the things, you know, we use your timelines constantly on the podcast, because we always start the publishing and writing history with what months these were written, and what was written before and what was written after. And I go to your website the very first thing when I'm starting to write show notes, and or open the book to those dates. And usually I have both open at the same time. So I use your dates all the time. How did you start sourcing those? Is it mostly from Rickman's book and Sutton?
Yes, I was just about to mention, yes, definitely one of the first things I did was read Greg Rickman's biography and Lawrence Sutton's, Divine Invasions. And I also got all those tapes that were going around back then with the interviews, I think, that Rickman did with various people. There was a Daniel DePrez interview. There was a lot of interviews on cassette tape. So I got all those. I listened, I took notes, and really the Philip K. Dick Society newsletter was really a wealth of information. I just got everything from everywhere, and I put it all in there, and then I had to sort it all out, which is what I did in Pink Bean.
Right.
Does that answer your question? You look a little unhappy there, David. Does that answer your question?
No, I'm not unhappy. No, it's exactly what I assumed it was, but what's really interesting to me is I've always had this picture of you like basically writing out each of the years and trying to basically figure out what he was doing each month of those years. So I just picture you going year by year. Is that how you did it, or eventually when you got down to doing the book?
Not really. Again, it was more like a sort of jigsaw puzzle, in a sense, like pieces fell into place here and there, and then I had to, you know, sort of link it together. One thing I did not want to do when I wrote this was attempt to write a biography. So I as far as his marital problems, his life, his what he ate for dinner, I could care less. You know, it's none of my business what he did with his personal life, is the way I look at it. So I was struck. I knew what I was doing. I stuck to the dates and the facts pertaining to the publication and the writing history of each of his books and short stories. I was firm on that, and I believe this is what was my guiding principle. I was focused on just that. I was not distracted by all the Pink Beams and that, even though I included all that in there because it's part of it, you know. But I figured here's what I think about Philip K. Dick, and I've thought about it for a while. He's like a genius, okay? I mean, you know, here we are. We're in the middle of an intellectual revolution, and I've commented on this before. And while you're in the middle of it, you can't really expect to pontificate on it and, you know, talk about it a whole lot in some sort of authoritarian way, because when you're in the middle of a revolution, you don't have enough perspective to step outside of it to see what the hell's going on. So I avoided all that. I avoided talk of Pomatics. I didn't analyze his novels, and you know, in a lot of people analyze it in psychological terms or whatever, you know, or whatever. They're maybe they're Marxist professors, so they write from a Marxist perspective or whatever, you know. I sort of ignored all that. I wasn't interested in it. I was just interested in the facts, because my point, and I believe Frank Hollander agrees with me on this, is you can't study something unless you have the basics down. And to get the basics down, you need to know when the shit was written, which is what I concentrate on with Pink Meat.
Well, look, and for me, I'm really interested in like how the events of his life informed the writer sitting down at the typewriter and creating these things. That's kind of my thing. So your book is invaluable to me because I can place all like the timeline and I can say this is what's going on. And for example, like we joke a lot about the amount of money the amount of money stress he was going under when he wrote like Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. And you very dispassionately point out like he wrote this letter about the money he owed on a parking ticket, you know, right around the time that was written.
Yeah.
But because of your book, we know that. And then me, the pontificator, can use those facts about the time. And, you know, not everybody's Frank Hollander. Frank, I can ask him, like, hey, did Phil attend the Hugo speech at the 68 convention? And he can tell me yes or no. And that's great. But not everybody can have that. So having the Pink Beam with as much information as possible about his timeline is so helpful for those of us who are doing biographies or writing books about what he's creating. So
right, well, this was my purpose, David, was exactly that it would form a foundation for further scholarship. And you, Professor Gill, David here, and a lot of, well, they're all over the world. There's people writing about Philip Dick now, you know, I mean, they're everywhere. And I hope that I contributed a basic reference in that sense. And I'm glad that you use it that way.
Well,
and I got the same comment from Maurizio Serenati, the Italian translator of Philip K. Dick books. And before he died, he wrote and said, yeah, I use Pink Beam a lot in when he's working on Philip K. Dick translations over there. You know, he translated The Exegesis, and he involved all the Philip K. Dick fans online here in America in the Facebook groups, and we all sent him comments on what different things meant. You remember all that back here about 10 years ago? Mm. And, yeah, I got to know him through that, and...
Did he translate the Lethem cut of The Exegesis?
Yeah, the big fat book. Yeah, he sure did.
But, I mean, that's Lethem pared that shit down, though, because there's a lot more that's not in there. But.
Yeah, I've always called for the complete publication of everything in The Exegesis. And Nick Buchanan, who publishes PKD Otaku with Patrick Clark, he has an illustration that can be unabridged Exegesis, like a big stack of books about this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you should know that at one point, Gil and I had to tell David Wilson down here. We were like, "No, you have to have the Pink Beam. You have to have it in your. You have to have it in your."
I do. Although, admittedly, I have yet to read it. But to follow up from before, if I may. You said, Lord Runningclam, that. You kind of stuck to brass tacks, right? Chronologically, in terms of dates, when things happen and all that. But, you know, inevitably, one of the book that I'm writing or conceiving of now has to do with Philip K. Dick's biographies. And one of my theses is that, you know, there's something about his writing, and we've talked about it variably in the past on this podcast. His writing invites makes people anxious in such a way where they get involved with it personally. You know, it's there is this biographical impulse that's sort of everywhere in his literature.
Mm-hmm.
When you, for instance, like how do you said that the Pink Beam includes a lot of you do mini reviews of the different stories and novels.
Yes.
And stuff. How do you affect those? What do you look at in your reviews? Is it like this is good and this is why, this is bad and this is why, or is it?
No, not at all. No. I have a rating of between 1 and 5 stars, and you know, I just for fun. It's what I personally like. Like I thought, like The Unteleported Man, I think is one of his best novels he ever wrote. It's been highly denigrated and dismissed, but I think the people who dismiss a book like The Unteleported Man ought to be slapped upside the head. So I gave it 5 stars, okay? I gave Stigmata 5 stars, Ubik 5 stars, Highcastle 5 stars, Scanner 5 stars, whole bunches of them. You know, some of them, like For My Tears, I'd give 4 stars, okay? And some of them I'd give 3. And I remember I gave, I think, 2 stars to Dr. Futurity and 2 stars to Vulcan's Hammer, 1 star to the short story, The Eyes Have It. You know, it's just a fun thing, man.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah, and I give little traces of the plot, and you know, try not like write a little blurb about this, particularly the short stories. I'd write a little blurb like you could have found on the back cover without giving away what the story's about, but some sort of blurb hinting at what the story was about.
And that's cool for general readers who want kind of an overview of the material, but also for researchers who can use it as reference material. Yeah.
Well, as a matter of David, let me continue it. Other David. David is on these little mini reviews. I mean, we've published the white books. Henri and I have published the novels in the UK and USA bibliography, the short story bibliography, UK, USA, and Oceania, and recently the French bibliography of Philip K. Dick published in France. And what's handy about that is I can use all these little blurbs I wrote in Pink Beam and just sort of slot them into these bibliographies to explain what the book's about, and then translate it. Henri translates into French, and it's there in French. You know, I'm doing the Italian bibliography right now, translated into Italian. You know, it's like it's an old Philip Dick trick. What are you, cut and paste sort of thing? You know, he's always using stuff from one story and plug it into another one. You know,
what's the French publication? Is it because the French loved Philip K. Dick?
I got one right here. I'll show it to you. It's called, what are you pronouncing in French? Precious Relic. Precious Relics.
Oh, wow. You see that? It looks nice. Yeah.
It's It is. It's a color, full color illustrations of every French publication that we could find to deal with Philip K. Dick between 1959 and 2018. When we published the book.
Well, and I always appreciated that about Pink Beam is that you were honest about some of the stories. I mean, like we are notorious on the podcast, for example, for, you know, like we get made fun of a lot because we had a listener get very, very angry because we hated Cosmic Puppets. And that we constantly beat up on Cosmic Puppets is a long running joke. And now we have one listener who hates us, despises us because of our anger at Cosmic Puppets, and it's kind of turned into a thing. But, you know, we have some, you know, obviously all of us have books that we like more than others and ones that, you know, we're all huge Three Stigmata fans here, you know, for example. But, you know, different ones we like at different levels, and that's okay. And even between the dickheads, you know, Anthony famously did not like Man in the High Castle, and Larry and I had to, like, we were just flabbergasted that he just...
It's a masterpiece, man. That's
well, I agree with you. I agree with you that it's a masterpiece, but, you know, he's a millennial. What can you do?
Well, I whenever I go out and you know, in general public, and I talk about Philip K. Dick, and, you know, a lot of the old timers out there, they remember The Man in the High Castle. People remember The Man in the High Castle, and they remember Blade Runner. Okay, so, you know, there you go from there. But I best get back to the Cosmic Puppets. I rate it with 5 stars because I think it's absolutely brilliant. So I would probably disagree with you on that one. Sorry.
Which is fine. And, you know, it's more than fair to somebody should come on the show and defend the Cosmic Puppets because we certainly beat up on it a lot. We especially hate the Boob Mountain ending of it. We've made fun of many times. But.
Well, here's the thing, David. Let me comment further. Cause to me, it's when you read it, when you read that first Philip K. Dick book, I don't know what it was in your case, but when you read that first Philip K. Dick book, and it hits you. You're in that book. You're in the middle of that book. You're not thinking about always writing about booze, or you're not thinking of anything outside of it, you know, or reflects on it. You're totally into it. And this is what I think that one of the greatness about Philip K. Dick was his ability to make his stories seem like, well, you're in this, you know, because he wrote about ordinary people in a sense, in strange circumstances, and he put you right in there, and you realized that, well, man, like I said, if I was to write this book, I'd write it exactly like this, you know. You're there. It's an immersive experience, not so much the same experience when you reflect on it. Because if you go back and read, say, like Eye in the Sky now, it's still a great book, but you don't have that immediate impact you had when you first read it. I know this is all for big fans say this, you know.
Well, and you're somebody who goes back from, I mean, even when you first got into things, that you had Blade Runner already, but the kind of explosion of Philip K. Dick, do you credit that to Total Recall and the because I think it's Total Recall is really where I, you know, I'd seen Blade Runner, but it was Total Recall that got me to go read the short stories. So that was a huge part of it for me, because I bought Volume 2 to get the stories, and I still have my copy of that over here, and I was just looking on the shelf. I don't know where I put it, but I was using it 2 days ago. But you know, that was the one for me that really blew it up. What do you attribute the huge explosion in Philip K. Dick in your time, Lord Running Clam? What do you think did it?
I would say it was not the movies. It was the novels themselves. You know, we're talking worldwide now. You know, he had good translators, and he was translated in you know, dozens of languages all over the world in the 90s, 80s, 90s, or in fact, all the way through his career. These foreign countries have been publishing his books. You know, his for France, 1959, Italy, 1956. You know, it's when they first published Philip K. Dick translations. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, and I believe that the books themselves, like me, they created all these fans all over the world. Just little groups of fans have popped up, and well, they call it a cult. It's not a cult. It's just thinking minds on the brilliance of this great writer. And I think that the books and the groundswell of articles, the academical articles, even though most of them are really bad, I've talked to Frank Bertrand about that, and I think it was more the books themselves that gave groundswell to the movie. Because I tell you, when Blade Runner first came out in 1982, it wasn't as well received as it is now. I mean, all the dickheads were complaining about, oh, they left mercenaries out there, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. It wasn't until probably 10 years in, sometime in the 90s, that people decided that Blade Runner was some sort of cinematic masterpiece, you know, which it obviously is in a sense, but it was not. In another real sense, true to the novel, you know. So we had a disagreement on that. I like Total Recall. I like I think Screamers is a really a good version of Second Variety. You know, the only thing it lacked was, man, they didn't push it enough. They didn't put enough money into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We liked Screamers on the Dickheads podcast. We appreciated it for its low budgetness.
But with Blade Runner, so the problem with Blade Runner when it came out, you know, it was everybody wanted Star Wars and was expecting Star Wars or some version of that. And it was very serious and very antithetical to what George Lucas was doing. But between Blade Runner, was there a Dick adaptation between Blade Runner and Total Recall? Did Screamers come before Total Recall? Total Recall was 90, 91 or so, right?
Yeah, Total Recall was 90, Blade Runner was 80. I think Screamers came out a little later. I could look it up. I don't have it at hand.
But. No, I'm pretty sure. But here's the thing about the Screamers screenplay, long before it ever got made, was very important to the timeline of things, because Dan O'Bannon had a screenplay of Second Variety called Claws that mm-hmm. was floating around Hollywood before Blade Runner got made. In the aftermath of Alien, and it actually, a lot of people believe that Dan O'Bannon's interest in Philip K. Dick is why Blade Runner, like Hampton Fancher, had an easier time selling Blade Runner, because Dan O'Bannon had interest. You know how Hollywood, like, one person has interest, somebody else wants to try and beat them to something? Yeah. And just like the same thing of, like, Paycheck started moving forward because Steven Spielberg was making Minority Report, right?
Right.
One leads to another. Are there any of the movies you like, Lord Ronnie Clam,
I totally despise Minority Report because to me it was just a bunch of bullshit. I'm sorry. I mean, Steven Spielberg, I have no love for him. If you remember back in 1982 when Blade Runner came out, its big opposition, its big competition in the movies was E.T. Okay, so E.T., of course, wiped the floor with Blade Runner and then took all the glory, you know, but they both came out in 82. So, you know, I like Total Recall because I thought it's hilarious. I like it like when Sharon Stone kicks him in the nuts and says, you know how much I hate this fucking planet. You know, that was a great line, I thought. So I like that one. I've seen them all. I used to have posters. I'd go to the movie theaters when they played them in the end, like Next and Paycheck. I'd go to the movie theater and say, can I have that poster when you guys are done with the run? They'd say, yeah, sure. So I'd go get the poster. You know, yeah. I had an original Blade Runner poster, believe it or not, great big gigantic fan. And of course, it got left for all my other stuff in Indiana, so I don't have it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, definitely Scanner Darkly is the one that feels most like Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Yeah.
But, you know, there's hits, and I think, you know, he brought a lot, those movies brought a lot of attention towards Phil. So I think, you know, in the end, it's a good thing. But let me
interject here while we're talking about the movies. I would also mention, you talked about A Scanner Darkly, but let's not forget Radio Free Album, you know, with John Allen Simon and Elizabeth Carr producing. I thought that was a brilliant movie because it's sort of, they're talking about, you know, it's like, okay, where's this movie going? It's just a regular sort of movie about 50s sort of thing going on or something, you know? And it just totally turned into the strangest movie I ever saw.
Tell us about what you're doing next year in Colorado, because we fully intend to be there.
All right. Okay. Well, all right. Well, you see this T-shirt I'm wearing. It's this is from the 2019 Philip K. Dick Festival we had, and if you can see it very well. There you go. That's from the 2019 festival we had in Fort Morgan, Colorado. So what happened was, I'll go into the history of these festivals, okay? In 2010, I was living up in Ward, Colorado, and me and my wife, we went to the casinos at Black Hawk. I don't know if you ever heard of these places or not, but Black Hawk is directly west of Denver. They built a fancy four-lane highway all the way up to the casinos in Black Hawk and Central City, all right? So a casino town. So we went up there and we played in the machines. I play slot machines, what the hell. And I was like $100 ahead, and we get ready to go home. And then a snowstorm snowed us in. So we're stuck overnight in Black Hawk in a hotel. Couldn't go nowhere. So we went back down and lost my $100 back in the slot machines. And it occurred to me just sitting there that night, it says, I got to do a Philip K. Dick Festival in 2010. It just bumped into my brain. I said, okay, I guess I got to do it. And I had no clue how to do it, but I did it. And you have to talk to the people. There was a lot of fun, not a lot of people, but some really, really brilliant people. David Gill was there. Oh, crikey. Eric Davis, Patrick Clark, Perry Kinman, John... I'm sorry, I forget all the names, but a lot of people showed up. Sam Umlin was there, and the theme was Man in the High Castle. You see this festival sign up here, this one up here. That's actual one of the actual signs we had outside the venue in Black Hawk. Or actually, what we did, we associated with a bar called the Last Shot, Bar and Grill Last Shot. It's a biker bar between Netherland, Colorado, and Black Hawk, right on the highway. And we had a convention there, man. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I mean, we can hardly hear ourselves talk from all the Harley Davidsons going off, you know what I mean? But it was a ball. And we had a blast, man. It was a lot of fun. So after that, I said, well, I can't really do festivals up here. Philip Dick's dead in Fort Morgan. And I said, so, well, we'd move operations to Fort Morgan. And it took from 2013 to 2017, working with the folk in Fort Morgan to actually be able to put this on in 2017, which we did. So we did the 2017 festival. It was great. And then we did the 2019 festival. We were going to do another one in 22, but I canceled it because of COVID. You know, COVID was still, you know, still in effect, basically, early 22, which would have been Phil's 40th anniversary of his passing, you know, in 1982. So we just had a little gathering up there, and there's something in the latest PKD Otaku, some fan comments about that and some photos. And then what fired off this one for next year was news of a Comic Con. I thought, well, hell, they got a Comic Con. There's 30,000 Philip K. Dick fans, possible Philip K. Dick fans there. Let's have another festival and invite them all down, you know, because I see the Comic Con as an opportunity to get people from, get the word out about how, you know, our festivals in Fort Morgan, how great a town Fort Morgan is. It's really, it's out in the prairie. It's like this self-contained, I mean, I think these guys in this town, I think, could solve any problem they ever faced. You know what I mean? There's a real competent bunch of people in that town. And we put on the festival, and I got to know them all, and we're preparing for next year right now. I have a team that we've put together where we got David Gill, Zach Wood, Cameron Mitchell, Henri Wentz, Brent Huizenga, and me. So there's six of us. And these guys are helping me and get it together in 2024. And the dates, so we already set the dates. I'll show you the sign I made up. You can't see it.
June 13th through the 16th, 2024. Yep, Fort Wayne, Colorado.
Eggs, are you going?
I am going. I have already committed.
I'll go.
Yeah.
Good. So, come on. We got some great people going to be there. I'm not sure who. I've asked David Gill to take care of because of his successful 2012 festival in San Francisco. I mean, he's got all these brilliant people, Rudy Rucker, Paul Salmon. Professor Gill did a great job. And I said, well, David, you know all these people. Why don't you invite these people to come on down? Of course, I'm stepping all over his toes wanting to get more people in there. But we're going to get there Thursday evening, David, if you're going to go, Thursday evening, Friday, Saturday, we'll have our speeches and all that. Friday, Saturday, we have our speeches. Saturday night, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We have had a little banquet and a musicians play and whatever. And we did a little play at the last one. But I'm not sure we're going to do that this year. Because what I really like about, what I really want to happen at these festivals is I want all the fans to get together, become friends, talk to each other, and get to know each other. You know, it's all about the fans, okay? And not so much lectures and watching, being entertained, but more involving amongst ourselves, you know, more friendships. So from 2010, the Black Hawk Festival I started, David Gill put on the 2012 festival in San Francisco. And it took 4 years to move on. I was a little frustrated at the time delay to the 2016 festival there in Riverside or Anaheim, wherever it was, you know, the big conference they had there at the, I forget what university it is now. So UC at Riverside.
UC where Riverside. I just went to do research.
You were just there. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so it's been a sequence. And to me, at least, I spoke to the fans at the 2012 festival in San Francisco. And part of my address was, you know, we need to put some place where Philip K. Dick can be separated and celebrated and have a place of his own. And I thought, well, if we leave it up to these guys in California, well, they're going to put it in San Francisco or somewhere. It's going to get lost amongst all the other things going on in San Francisco. But if we do it in Fort Morgan, it's a big deal. You know, it's got its own place. It's separate. It's a major thing for that town. Well, not the, you know what I'm saying, in relative speaking. It's something that the town can get behind, and it will be something separate and indistinct, distinct from California. In other words, we'll put about on the prairie. Why not? Where is that?
That makes sense. I think that's cool too, because that's also where he's laid to rest. And you know, that's obviously something that is important. So here's the thing, like, as somebody who gets down and nitty gritty and, you know, it's somebody who likes to think about like these little important moments in his life. The Pink Beam has been a constant, you know, source of information for me. And so Of course, I could nerd out all day on the nitty-gritty of how you do that, but I don't think the listeners will be as interested as I am in that aspect. Although I love hearing your stories. I did not know this about you, that you were traveling around doing the Slime Mold on Tour thing. That's great. Got to read your book about that. That sounds hilarious. It sounds like a really good time for one
thing. There's other stuff in that book too. There's a lot of articles I wrote for PKD Otaku in there, and it's like a miscellany of crap I wrote since the 80s. So there's politics, bad politics. Who gives a shit about 1988 election? But I got a couple things in there about it. And
still in print from Wide?
Wide Book, yeah. Yeah. You get on Amazon. Go to Amazon, type in Ganymede and Slime Mold on Tour. It's like...
So where do you feel what do you feel about, you definitely are still involved, you want people to come to the festival, so where would you like to see PKD scholarship go in the future?
Well, I would like to see it go to Fort Morgan into an institute there that they can build and run, and they invite artists in residence, scholars in residence, and they do the whole academic thing where people talk about and have a retreat sort of thing. That's my dream. But that's just a dream where we're only beginning. I will never see it because, shit, I'm 72 years old now. I'm half fucking dead, you know what I mean? So I won't see it. I hope someday that Fort Morgan will take on Philip K. Dick as their own. They have a favorite son there. It's that musician, Glenn Miller. Glenn Miller would spend his youth in Fort Morgan. So they have in the museum there, they have a big Glenn Miller exhibit and celebrated in the town. They have Glenn Miller days and all this, you know, the old band musician, the old big band musician from the 40s or whatever, you know. Well, Philip K. Dick, I mean, I've been talking with him for years and getting closer and closer to them putting a permanent exhibit in the Fort Morgan Museum, so that when fans, because people go to Fort Morgan from all over the world, they go to the grave, they put their little trinkets on the grave or whatever, and they hang out in the town. Wouldn't it be great to have a little museum exhibit they could go see too? In other words, it attracts Philip K. Dick fans into Fort Morgan.
Right, I totally agree.
And I love the idea of a writer and artist in residence too. I mean, facilitating and supporting that sort of thing. That would be great.
Well, then again, back to Fullerton or San Francisco, as compared to Fort Morgan, not only you have it's different. It's a different environment, and you will get different perspectives. You being a scholar, David, you'd know this. Sure. You're going to get better, different opinions out of the people living in Fort Morgan, Colorado, where they. Not in the big city, you're going to get different things out of the big city. I think that there's room for everybody. I mean, David Gill is talking about maybe doing something in San Francisco in 2028, another festival, which would be great. I say there's room for everybody, man. Go for whatever you want to do, David. Both you, Davids, do whatever you want. We're all fans together.
All the Davids working together. We're all working on it.
Not me. Yeah, that's right, man. It's a worldwide phenomenon of appreciation for a great and brilliant writer. It's just not stopped. It's still going on. I mean, golly, you go to these foreign countries, you'd be amazed at the stuff they're doing. Italy's got all these, I don't know how they do it. Italy have all these weird salons and stuff, and they talk about that they have their little festivals, and it's going on everywhere. And I like to think that we started it in 2010 again because we know it's happening in the 90s. In England, there was Nick Buchanan telling me about the one he went to in 1994 where Paul Williams was there, and I can't remember who else, maybe Greg Rickman, a whole bunch of, those 90s dickheads were there. Well, there was nothing happening then, because what happened was, see, it all comes back to Paul Williams for me, and I've written about this. Paul Williams, as we know, he brilliant man, he had a bicycle accident, I forget, maybe 1995 or something, that caused him all kinds of health problems, and I guess he eventually died, or he couldn't do what he was doing before, and I was out there waiting, well, when's Paul Williams going to have this festival? And it never happened, and I finally found out that he'd been, or had this accident, and he couldn't do it, so I thought, well, shit, I guess this is why I got to do it, Like, who am I, right? But who am I? I'm Lord fucking Running Clan, man. Who the hell are you? That's what I'm saying. So I did it.
Well, yeah. That's where the timeline comes in, too, because Paul Williams becomes important, and we can discover this because in summer of 77, Joan pulls Phil up to Sonoma, and he and Paul mm-hmm. already knew each other because he had written the Rolling Stone piece, but that summer that he was in the same city as Paul Williams is one of the things that deepened their connection and ended up, you know, is why he trusted Paul to run his literary estate when he died.
Right.
If he didn't run his literary estate, who knows how strongly we would have had the push towards the vintage editions and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Paul Williams is crucial to Philip K. Dick fandom. He was basically the founder of Philip K. Dick fandom in 1982 with being his executor and starting the newsletter. I mean, the Philip K. Dick newsletter brought us all together from all over the world. It made contacts that were very critical for me anyway, and I think for other people too.
Professor Wilson, do you have any other questions for Lord Running Plan?
One is there. So do you continue to work on fresh material? Like, is there stuff that are you currently working on anything PKD related? How about that?
Yes, I am. In concert with Henri Wentz, White Books, white-books.com, we're working on the Italian bibliography, and then we're probably about 70-75% done. We've got the main part of the bibliography done, but now it's the accompanying essays and all this that we have to write and put in there. It's taken us years. I mean, it's been an on again, off again thing. So the bibliography is definitely pressing. I always write an article with some sort of PKD otaku, and I'm thinking of putting together a thing to commemorate the fans, you know, from my experience. In other words, my experience as a fan and, you know, photographs of all these weird things that we have here, a sort of a memento for Philip K. Dick fans about ourselves, basically, you know. I've always got several things going on, but not all of them reach fruition, you know.
Yeah.
Being a professor, I'm sure you know all about that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have lots of stuff.
What is your field, David, by the way? What do you teach?
So I actually have a master's in science fiction studies, but my PhD was just in my dissertation was on science fiction, but mostly American literature and African-American literature.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Not film studies.
Well, I got a question for you then.
Sure.
Now, one of the my big and my big complaints about Philip K. Dick's scholarship is you as you know, everyone's writing theses and this, and they're publishing all these journals, and there's big long lists of them from all over the world. Is people will say something about Philip K. Dick or write their opinions out or whatever, but it seems to me they've not really done their research. You know, it's easier to say something in a glib fashion, you know, whatever. You know, Philip K. Dick was affected by his mother's drug addiction or whatever, you know, though his mother.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? It's real easy to say that sort of thing. But my thing here is, you've been an English professor, and I've talked to Professor Gill about this, is what we need is an English literature critique of Philip Dick's work that is up to date, that, you know, because now, okay, when you're talking about criticism, literary criticism, people, they use common terms like memes, icons, all these things that you hear people talk about. Okay, well, where did the term meme come from? How did it originate? What part of what literary theory do these terms come from? What is the applicable literary theory that we're operating on? In other words, the received literary theory to criticize literature. Because my point is, Philip K. Dick is a friggin' genius. He changed the whole modus of criticism. In other words, you can't criticize Philip K. Dick in some old-fashioned school of criticism. He needs to be criticized in a different way. But we have to understand where the criticism's coming from before we can formulate the new way of criticizing. You know what I'm saying? So it's a job for you as a literary professor to tell me what the hell is going on? I know you ain't got time for it now.
No, I mean, that's a long question and that we've debated a little bit here. I'll give you a short answer. I'll try. I am very much interested in the texts themselves. I am, unlike, for instance, David Agronoff, who is ultimately interested in the biographical aspects of Philip K. Dick's literature.
Yeah, I try to be absolutely.
I love biographical criticism too, and everything having to do with biography and autobiography. But as a literary critic, let's say, I'm interested almost exclusively in the texts themselves. So, for instance, the book that I'm going to be writing on the biographies will focus on those biographies and how they criticize precisely what you're saying, Lord Running Plan, how they rather symptomatize Philip K. Dick's the actual man vis-a-vis his literature. And I think that's entering dangerous territory by saying, oh, this happened, for instance, in a book, hence this must be happening in his life. When I make claims of that, well, I wouldn't say claims of that nature, I'm very careful about historical context. And if I tread into waters where I think that I might violate that, I shy away from it, you know? But you're absolutely right in saying people feel, and again, this goes back to Philip K. Dick's writing, being very kind of invoking this sort of personal relationship with it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
People feel very free to do that again and again, despite potentially, taking liberties with truth. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always back to the pink bean quote. It's always back to Valis. You know, it's like back to Valis. Valis, the masterpiece, you know, what did this book do to literature? Well, in my mind, it destroyed literary categories, genre categories. You know, it just blew them away. This is a whole new thing right here. And until we can explain what's come before and understand what's come before, not only just in the term of publication genres, you know, what the publishers, you know, you get these the science fiction now, you got to write a big fat book before you can even sell it. You know, it's like publishers' demands. And Philip Dick, as we know, fought against this whole life long to get his mainstream acceptance. Yeah. So we have to understand where we're coming from before we can apply this knowledge to what Philip K. Dick did to the broad literary criticism. You know, what did he do? I mean, he changed it. I mean, we talk about the Pink Beam and how he brought his life and all of his previous books into this whole exegesis-like proposition, you know. But you know, people say, oh, he's agnostic, he's this, he's that, he's all this. But to my point of view, he's a writer. He's a science fiction writer. He makes shit up. So I think that he maybe had this weird Pink Beam experience, the authenticity of which even Tesla, I've heard, puts to doubt. I'm not sure.
This very podcast.
yes, I was actually listening to it the other day. And how do we go from here? Is what I'm saying. He changed the nature of literature.
To kind of tie things up a little bit, that's one of the reasons why your work, Lord Running Clam, is so important to us. Because you've given us this timeline, you've done that work and for the years, and for me personally, I have to publicly thank you, because so much of the research that was done for this podcast has been done via your work, and I just want you to know that you have done so much of the legwork that we use for this podcast. And so we'll hear your work echoed in almost every episode.
Well, thank you, David. I'm glad that you guys read my book and find it useful, because I come from the position of a Philip K. Dick fan. I'm like a Manchester United fan. Philip K. Dick is the best writer in the fucking world, and I don't want to hear about anybody else. You know what I'm saying? So, and this is another. I'm sorry, I said we're running late. This is another one of my pet peeves about criticism of Philip K. Dick. Oh, well, you know, his writing is good, it's bad. You don't know how to write. What? Give me a fucking break. You don't know how to write. Who do you compare him to? John Creasy, Updike, F. Scott Fitzgerald? These are books that are written from an objective sense. In other words, the writer's writing a book and it's in a sort of third person or something. Well, when you read Philip K. Dick, you ain't reading no distance between you and Phil. There's no distance between you and Phil when you read that novel. It's right there. You're that novel. You're that character in that novel, that protagonist. Yeah. I can't believe anybody can say Philip K. Dick's a lousy writer in any aspect whatsoever. So I always jump over to ask. I'm a fan, okay? Manchester United's number one. Philip K. Dick's number one. And I will put all the other teams and all the other books and other writers below all of Philip K. Dick's works. So people say, well, give me, you see these lists here on the internet. Well, what's the 50th greatest science fiction books all the time? I always say, well, we'll put all kind of Philip K. Dick's novels at the top of the list and append everybody else at the bottom, okay? Which is a fanish attitude. So I'm a fan. I book no criticism. And I'll take anybody on that score. So how's that?
Okay. Well, listen, that is a great note to end on. Like serious passion. How can people find your work? And can they follow you online, or are you not a social media creature? I don't think you're a social media creature.
I got disgusted with it because Facebook a number of years ago, probably about the time that orange piece of shit showed up, 2015 or so, 2016, and I found myself online arguing politics with a bunch of strangers all the time. I just said, hell with this. I don't want to deal with it. And I don't. I've got a Facebook account. I forgot my password. And every time I try and go there, it says, what's my password? Well, I don't remember what it is, so I never go there, you know? So,
They can find Wide Books online, and they can find the Pink Beam Companion is Wide Books. Pink Bean Companion is out there. People can buy it if you don't have it.
For Pink Bean, with that one up there, it's on lulu.com. It's where they sell it at. But if you search for Pink Bean by our Lord RC, it'll pop up in the search results. And everything that we do for White Books is published through Amazon's publishing service. So in other words, Amazon is the one who does the printing. It's, you know, print on demand, you know. Sure. White Books. Sure. Yeah.
And then every time somebody has thought, David, how does David know this when I'm giving dates or whatever? It's you, sir. Like a lot of time, most of the time, it's Lord Running Clam's research. So again, thank you so much for that. Professor Wilson, do you have anything else you wanted to say?
I'm good. So nice to meet you, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
We'll see you next in Colorado year. Next year. Yeah.
June 13th to 16th, 2024, Fort Morgan, Colorado. It's a beautiful town, and you guys will love it there, and I hope to see you then. Thank you, David.
You know, see us all there. We'll all be hanging out. And you can.
Yeah, we don't know what we're going to do yet, but it'll be good. How can I say that? I'm not sure what we're going to do. We're still working it out. We won't even kick in the high gear until August because there's so much going on, you know. But we'll have a good time in Fort Morgan. It's a nice town, they're wonderful people. It'll be great.
All right. Well, as we always sign off on Dickheads, keep it paranoid, stay paranoid.